What's your name?
My whole name?
Sure.
All right.
Or just how would you like us to if you were to introduce yourself to me, how should
I would say, hello, I'm Riggy. That's my name that everybody has called me since I can remember. Matter of fact, I didn't know my real name until I was 7 years old. When my mother decided that she had to send me to school, I had to get an educate. And the little things like, don't you want to learn how to read? And I'll say, no, I know. And she said, don't you want to learn how to read the news, the funny papers all by yourself? No, I don't want to do this. I don't want to leave. You know, because I was the only one. And my older sister stayed with my grandmother. But I was on a boat with my mother and father. As that was my home. And I just didn't want to leave. But I had to leave it when I was 7.
Okay.
And that's when, I'll never forget this. My father said, don't forget to tell her what her name is. And I looked at him and I said, is my name Riggy? And Mama said, oh, no, my God. She said, I've got to remember. Your name is Isabel. No, your name is Isabella. And I said, how do you spell that? You know? And so my mama thought for a little while, and she said, Isabelle. I said, okay. But I had that ride, the 2-hour ride from the boat to the car to learn how to spell my name. And Gedoria came even a little harder. Gedoria. That was easier to do than Isabelle. But it doesn't stop there. I went to school and that, you know, at that time you had to have your birth certificate, and then I made my communion and everything. I had on my birth certificate that aunt that I told you about. She spelled the name. The midwife. When I was born, the midwife asked my mother, she says, you're going to have another girl. What do you want to name her? She asked my mother. And my mother said, well, I named my first daughter after my mother. She said, so maybe I'll name my second daughter after my husband's mother. But you have to go ask him how to spell it. So she said, okay. So she says, well, you have another daughter. Your wife said, what kind of name you want to give her? He said, oh, he said, I guess I'll spell it, I'll name her Isabel after my mother. And so she, being French, she wrote on the birth certificate, Isabelle. Okay? Then this aunt and my uncle, who was Filipino, took me to get christened and everything, and he spelled my name Isabella. And here I am in school, and I don't know how to spell my name, which way to spell my name. Luckily, there was another girl in the same room whose name was Isabel, Isabel. So I copied her, so I got that one. I said, it would have been so much easier if I just would have wrote Riggy, R-I-G-G-I. Oh, yes, there was always some kind of confusion there.
That's right. Okay. So, let's see. So for the story, can you say, I'm Isabel, however you want us to, okay, and tell us where we are today and tell us what we're doing.
I'm Isabel Gedoria Welch. My husband and I are going to be married 56 years. 57 years. 57 years. June 9th. This year. This year. And we have two sons, Mario and Mark. And I have six grandchildren and six great-grandchildren. We're very proud of that. We love that. And
So I was going to ask you, what did you do? What do you do?
Now, thank goodness, I'm just a housewife and grandparent. Yes.
What did you do before that?
Oh, I was in a classroom for 40 years. I taught school. In a Catholic school and in public school, right here in the same little neighborhood. It was just wonderful. I enjoyed those years immensely. I love teaching. I was very, very happy doing that. I started kind of late for a person who taught not so long, but I enjoyed every bit of it. Yes, I started in Catholic school and ended up in public school.
Where are we now? What neighborhood are we in?
We're in, actually, we're in New Orleans. This is the part of New Orleans that's called Algiers. But it's part of New Orleans, the only part on the West Bank. That is, further on down, you get the other little towns, you know, like Marrero and those kind of places, yes.
And when you were teaching, what grades did you teach?
I taught all the grades. Mostly I taught third grade and sixth grade. But I taught all the grades from first to sixth. First through sixth, yes. Different schools, different situations and everything. But I had covered most of those grades. My parents. My mother was born and raised right here in the city, but my daddy was born in the Philippine Islands. I knew the place. No, not Cebu. In Manila. Yeah, in Manila. I don't know too many of his his people. Matter of fact, we only met one of his cousins for a little while, and then when he took off, well, we hadn't seen him anymore for a long time, and we just assumed that, you know, that he expired. He was never married, so he didn't have any family at all either.
So okay, and when did your father come to Louisiana? When did he come to the States?
He came to the States to work in the fields, the fruit orchards in California, and I got it right over here.
Sure.
He was, let's see. I wrote this because it was just something that was told to me. My father, this boy of 14 was put in a seminary where he learned to read and write. At 16, he ran away by swimming the river. He stayed in hiding until he and some friends joined a migratory workers group headed for California in 1910. Please keep in mind the results of the Spanish-American gave the U.S. complete control of the Caribbean Sea, Guam, and the Filipinos in 1899. No passports, etc., were needed to come to the United States. Inocencio and friends stayed about 3 years working with seasonal crops. A group headed for Alaska to fish salmon in 1915 during a storm. He and two friends were caught in the quick-forming ice. One friend died. The other had his hand amputated. He was being on the oars. You know, his hands were frozen. This caused much pain, and he was incapacitated for some time. He traveled around with friends working as a laborer. On December 2nd, 1920, he and buddies joined the U.S. Army to Fort Douglas, Utah. In the spring of 1921, he was transferred and recruited Educational Center of Camp Travis, Texas. In July of that year, you know, an honorary discharge. In September of the same year, he came to New Orleans, and that's when he was working for a shipping company.
Uh-huh. So let's kind of go over that again. So
okay,
where was your dad from?
It's in the Fruita part. In the front part, I guess I must have that written.
You got a lot written down.
Yeah. The Jidori line. You know, I don't have that written down. Eno's father moved from Jidori's home.
That's okay. So what did we say? Mm-hmm. You came from the Philippines, or how was that? Okay.
I know from Manila. Okay. Manila, mostly. Okay. Yeah.
So, if you could tell us again, please. So, where did your father come from?
My father came from, I'm sure, from Manila, the Philippine Islands.
And when did he come to the States?
In about 1920. Yes.
Do you mind saying that my father came, or he came?
Oh, my father came from Manila, Filipino Islands, in about 1920, and he worked in California, and then went up to Alaska, came down to Utah, and then to Texas, stayed in Texas for a little while. Matter of fact, I think maybe he had even... Let's see, there he is up there. World War One. He just missed World War. They were getting on a ship to go overseas when the war ended. So that was lucky.
Yeah. So he. What brought him to Louisiana?
Well, the whole group of them that were in his company, wanted to go where the Philippine people were. So they went to Texas, and they stayed there a little while. And then they said they knew that in St. Malo over here in Louisiana, they had some Filipinos. So they came here, and then from St. Malo, they came to Louisiana. And into the New Orleans area, and I had a great grand aunt. My grandmother's aunt was married to a Filipino, and she had a 3-story house, and they'd always go over there because they could always find a room over there with my grandfather. And so that's where my grandfather went to. And then my mother went visiting her aunt one time, and that's when she met my daddy.
Okay. Yeah. Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up right here in New Orleans. And the bayous of Louisiana. Yeah. Yeah. The bayous around Manila Village and Four Bayous and close to the, that's my son now.
Okay.
Close to the what's name? Open the door, Bill.
Can I repeat that question again? So where did you grow up?
I grew up mostly around in New Orleans, and algae is, and all the little fishing camps and stuff that are around the Gulf of Mexico. That the my father's boat was my home until I was almost 7 years old.
So would it be fair to say you grew up in Manila Village as well?
Oh, yeah, most of the time, yeah.
Do you mind saying that?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. Think of it this way. We're both writing the story together.
Yes. Mostly I was born and raised around and in Manila Village and the other little shrimping and bayou things because my father was a fisherman, and the boat that we lived in was my home. We lived in the boat, and we worked on the boat and everything, and it was not until I was 7 years old that my mother decided that I had to learn how to read, that she sent me to the city to go to school.
So are you saying you spent the first 7 years of your life
on the boat? Oh, yes.
So you
did. Yeah, I spent the first 7 years of my life on a boat. Yes. Yes, indeed. We lived in camps sometime, you know, like the wintertime were really bad being on a boat because you're surrounded by water. But my dad used to trap in the wintertime. So he'd build a little cabin, maybe a little one-room shack, you know, right next to the canal where the boat would be. And so we would be like have a little shack, you know, and all. But once the season changed and everything, we were back on the boat. And that's where we lived.
Can you tell us what's the thing that you remember most about living in Manila Village?
In Manila Village or on the boat?
You know what? Let's tackle it one at a time.
Okay.
What do you remember most about living
in the boat?
In the boat.
Okay. The thing I remember most and will never forget, the fact that I could not see off the boat. Because you see, the boat goes like this, you know. And we lived in the bottom of the boat. You understand? The bottom of the boat. It was very comfortable and everything, but I was small. And the edge of the boat was no further than my eyes. And that's what I saw. I saw everything. I like that. From this end to that end was this from the top of my eyes. And that was it. And yeah, lots of times if we go to my aunt's camp or something like that, well, my mother would pick me up and put me on the top, and I'd go and walking on the platform or on the camp or the wharf or whatever. I'd walk and then that was it, you know. That was really good. But the thing I remember the most and the thing I hated the most was the fact that I was no taller than the eyes, you know, that I could see only just from the eyes.
So what did you see then from your perspective?
Well, I saw other boats. I saw other people. I saw people with my cousins and all when they would come, would want to play, would want to go swimming or everything like that. Well, my mother would let me and take me, and they'd take me to go to the end of the wharf, and we'd jump off the wharf and swim. And I didn't even know how to swim. I was 14 years old before I even learned how to swim. But that was one thing. I was never afraid of the water. And, of course, I had good, wonderful cousins that used to take care of me all the time. You know, boys, two boys. They treated me like one of the boys.
Now, living in a boat, did you, by the way, what did your father do with the boat?
I mean, he was a commercial fisherman. He used to eat a trawl for shrimp.
Do you mind saying my father, so we know who we're talking about?
Start again.
Sure.
My father was a commercial fisherman, and he used to most of the time trawl. He, my mother, and I were on the boat, and she did all the thing that a sailor would do on the boat, you know. You know. Plus, she would do everything what a woman would do on the boat. She'd do the cooking, the washing, and everything else. But like cleaning the shrimp, you know, and that was a big, big job, cleaning shrimp. And I learned that got stuck that so many times by catfish and got grabbed by crabs so many times and all. But to me, it was like fun, you know, it was like fun.
Now, did you have to work on the boat as well?
Oh, yes, I always worked on the boat, yes. I remember the time that my father would, it's unbelievable, I could close my eyes and see. My father had a round bottom boat, and it would sail with the wave like that, you see? And then it would come around again, and most boats would go like this and flop down and go like that and flop down, but not my daddy's boat. My daddy's boat was round bottom, so it went with the wave and everything. And at one point, if you looked on both sides of you, all around you, you would see nothing but like a mountain of water. You in between two mountains of water, you know. And so whenever we get in a situation like that, my daddy would grab me and he'd put me on they had a bunk bed in the cabin that was above the engine of the boat. He'd take and put me on top of that bunk bed, and then I would be safe, you know, because the cabin covered all the rest of the thing. I could still see everything, you know, but I would be safe. And then when we would get into clear water and still water, he'd let me down, and I'd go about my business, you know, walking around the boat, picking up crabs and stuff.
I want to clarify, was the boat, there was an engine already. It was meant...
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes.
Okay. I just want to make sure
Not kerosene. Gasoline.
Okay.
Gasoline engine.
Okay.
Okay.
But yeah. Later on, we had diesel. Yeah, because that was good. That you could depend on it better than kerosene. I mean, gasoline, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So tell us what it was like, if you could. You know, we can't see this, okay? But take us to the boat when you were helping your parents during the shrimping or fishing season.
Oh, okay. We usually would get up like before 4 o'clock in the morning, and we'd head out to where Daddy would think maybe there might be some shrimp, you know. And when we'd get there, we'd let down the tail of the trawl, and That would be one of my good jobs, because at the tail of the trawl, it had a long rope and it had a huge caulk that held the tail up a little bit, you see. I'm sorry, I didn't bring that. I'd have to get that thing to show you. There's a lead line on the bottom that goes across the trawl like this, and a caulk line that goes up the top. And the two boards hold it open enough that the boat drags the trawl along, you see? And so you catch anything that would go between that lead line and that caulk line. And... sometimes he would drag 2, 3, maybe 4 hours, and then would haul it in. Before he had devices to help pull it in, he used to pull in the ropes by hand. And then the boards was just, 5 feet tall and 4 feet long. So I always used to pull in the board and hook it around that post that Dad had there, and move to the other side, and he'd pick up his board, and then he'd come and pick up my board, and then we'd pull the lead line in first and over, and then bring the cork line in, and then he would catch that cork that held the tail of the trawl around to the side of the boat, and if there were too much in there for my dad to pick up, by hand, you know, he'd use the dip net. We'd put some planks across, and we'd hook the trawl onto that, and he'd dip the thing up on onto the deck.
What happened then once you trawled mm-hmm. the shrimp? What happened? Let's wait until he calls. Okay, so.
What happened? If we caught a lot of shrimp, he just put it up on the deck, and of course the shrimp, fish, crab, everything had to go in there. And so, and then he would tie the tail out again and send it out again, the tail of the trawl. And when while we're dragging a second time, we'd be separating the shrimp and from everything else that was on the deck, you see. And then by the time maybe we'd finished doing that, because it was just me and Mom and Daddy too, you know. We'd finished doing that, we'd be time to pick up the other drag. And so we'd pick up the other drag, and we'd make maybe 2-3 drags a day, and then we'd head into Manila Village, and, you know, because we had a camp in Manila Village, and we stayed there.
And then what did you do when you went to Manila Village?
Well, there was always a men there, men that worked on the platform that helped Daddy wash and put the shrimp in huge baskets, and they drag it. Well, they had like a little cart going, you know, to the boiling room, and they'd boil the shrimp, you see, and then take it out and spread it out on a platform, you see, and the sun would dry it, you see, and then they would have. You see, that's the place where they did that. But that's just the opposite. It's not the way it really was. Because this was a cover of a boat.
This is radio, so we can't see. Right? Uh-huh. So you're pointing to a picture?
Yes. The it was a cover of a magazine. But it's just the opposite. That part there is supposed to be in the back over there, you see. But
so what happened then? So once they dried?
They dried, yes, dried by the sun, and then the men would take care of that. If it looked like it was going to rain, they had things made out of wood that they would put right over it and then covered up with the tarpaulin. Okay. And then they would... protect it until the sun would stop, the rain would stop, and then they'd open up again. And then they'd bring it to the edge of the platform, and they would dance the shrimp. Did you hear about dancing the shrimp?
Tell us about dancing the shrimp, because...
After the shrimp would get really, really... excuse me a minute. I have to go to the bathroom.
Okay.
And when the shrimp would get real dried...
All right. Can you start again?
Yeah. Okay. When the shrimp would get real, real dried, and they'd spread the shrimp out onto the platform, and it looked like they were dancing on it. They'd put big brogans on. You know what brogans are? They're like big, big, heavy, heavy shoes. You know, heavy, heavy shoes. And they'd get on that shrimp. I mean, sometimes it would be anywhere from 4 to 6 men. And they'd stamp on the shrimp like that. And that's how where that first thing came from, about dancing the shrimp. And it was men that did that. It was not women.
You saw this?
Oh, yeah. We went, but the children always wanted to try to get in there with them, you know, and do that with them. But of course, we didn't have the big shoes that you know, and
did they when they danced the shrimp? Was there music?
No. Sometimes. There would be a harmonica, you know, or some people would, I forget what it was, but anyway, was kind of they would do that to music. Sometimes they would do it to me. You see, like right over here, they got a man with a little guitar. Looks like he's got a little guitar, and that's what he's doing there. And then they bring it into this house over here on the edge of the platform, and they had a big a machine, but not a big machine like the next one they had. This was worked mostly by hand, and it would move the shrimp back and forth until all the shells were off and the only thing was left would be the dried shrimp. And they'd pack that in big barrels and ship it to China, Russia, Puerto Rico, and all those little bit. Can you imagine? I didn't realize I did that until I really looked into it, you see.
What are we looking at?
This is Manila Village, the way this girl saw it.
What is this?
This is that place where in one of the little shrimping industry. What would you call it? It was not a camp. It had a huge platform that they would boil the shrimp and then bring it out to the platform on the back, and the platform was made like this. And they'd lay that shrimp on the top wave, and if it looked like rain was coming, they'd pull tarpaulin over that. And as soon as the rain was gone, they'd take the tarpaulin off and let the shrimp be exposed to the sun. It was after it was cooked and exposed to the sun, it became dried shrimp, you see, and sent to so many places. It was amazing. Mm. I didn't really realize how far that went.
I'm sorry. I meant to ask, what is this? What are we looking at? This is a picture.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's what I was getting. because again, our listeners can't see this.
Uh-huh, yes. Yeah. It's a picture of Manila Village. That was one of the top and the last one of the fishing villages that was left in southeast southwest.
Okay, you can start over again. Let's say this is a picture. Mm-hmm. Here's a picture of
Manila Village, not exactly as was that exactly the way how. The grandfather of this girl had explained it to her, but not exactly how it was. And since it was on a cover of a magazine, this would be the cover like this. And this would really be in the back of this side, you see. But
She didn't
make any changes. She just put down how her grandfather was telling her. You see, this is the way I understand, and it's pretty good. It's pretty good because, but of course, you know, after it was folded, this part would have been on the side, which would have been the right thing. You see, I've got more pictures of Manila Village better than this, but I had given the last picture that I had to a fellow who's making a collection of things, but I'm gonna go back and asked him if I could borrow it and make some copies of it, you know, because too many, a lot of people, I'm really amazed at the number of people who know about this, you know, and want to know more.
Well, yeah. Okay, and I'm sure our listeners would want to know more. So you were there, you saw how the shrimp were dried, how they were harvested, cooked, and dried. Can you take us there? What did it smell like? Do you remember how it smelled?
Oh, yes, that's a smell you never forget. For a while there, it smelled just like boiled shrimp. You know, and if you like shrimp, you know, and most people did, it was okay. But then later on, as time went on, it began where you had to get rid of the shrimp shells and stuff, you know, and everything, and the shrimp were barreled and the taken away and everything. At certain times, and if the wind was right, you know, at certain times it would be very bad. That's the reason why I think a lot of people lived on their boats, because they could drive the boats away out of the smell of the village, you see, and get a good night's sleep. You see, and sometimes we used to even after we delivered, we'd go back to the place where we would start trawling again the next morning, and sleep over there. You see, it was a full day's work, a full day's time. Yes, indeed.
And what was it like living in camp? This is part of the camp of Manila Village. So tell us, what was it like living in Manila Village?
What
do you remember most?
I dearly loved it. I was just like the rest. My father never had a son, and he was the only one of the brothers of my mother's family that never had a son, and. But I was the nearest thing he ever had to a son. And until I had to go back at 7 years old, I had to go lie down and learn how to read. And that was the part of my life I guess I most enjoyed, because that's the part of life that most children, I think, enjoy. May imagine going to sleep in a boat and waking and playing on boat. You could jump in the water anytime you wanted to, you know, swim and everything, and do things that boys did, you know, the boys. It was boys that seemed like that they had the fun. You know, and the girls had to stay home and sew and knit and learn how to cook and stuff like that. Wash dishes. That's the thing I hated the most, was washing dishes.
What would you rather do? Would you rather help catch shrimp or wash dishes?
Oh, to help catch shrimp anytime. anytime. I didn't like girls' work. I still like to do boys' work all the time. But that's the first part of my life. I always think of my life as being in parts, and that was the first part of my life, you see, the first part. And then the second part is that going to school and having to learn to be a girl, I guess, and going to school, and I learned to play an instrument. I had an opportunity to get an instrument, to play an instrument, and went to high school, played in the orchestra and everything, and then another part of my life started when the professor in my orchestra recommended me to somebody who was looking for a girl who played the cornet or the trumpet, and so they gave me a full scholarship, music scholarship, if I would go and play in the orchestra.
What did you play?
A trumpet.
I'm sorry.
Trumpet,
you,
yeah. Uh-huh. And but once I got there, learning how to be in, it was an all-girl college. That was another part of my life. I had to learn all over again. This was how to be the girl, to be a girl. and yes, it was wonderful. That was a wonderful part of my life. I enjoyed too, going to school, because I used to like school.
May I ask, going back to your time in Manila Village,
mm-hmm.
What was it that you like about it? You said you like because you felt like you could be a boy.
Yes.
It sounded like it was such a carefree life.
Oh, yes, carefree. Well, it seems like the boys got to do everything, you know? They got to work with the trawl, work on the boat, you know, do things that that boys do. Girls always had to stay inside and wash dishes and cook meals and stuff like that. No, I like that part of the life I like being a boy. But once I got the scholarship to go to college, you know, I had to learn all again how to be a girl. I be a girl.
You know, some people would look at your childhood and say, you know, that's a lot of work for a young girl.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Working on the boat, on the fishing boat. Picking through shrimp. I mean, that's a tough life, but you seem to have fond memories of it.
I used to have fun. I used to be with my father all the time. And when there was something to do on the boat, he'd say, "Baby, come here. Hold this," you know. And I don't care. I don't ask if what, why, or what. If it was something heavy, light, or didn't make any mind, I'd hold it. You know, or do this or do that. And I never knew this until one time my mother heard my daddy call me, and she came out to look, and she said, and it was something to hold. And she went, "Doria?" And it was too late, because he already did what he wanted to do, you know. And he said, she came out there and she said, "You keep forgetting she's a girl. She can't hold anything heavy as that." And I said, "But I did."
I was a pipe.
I was holding. He wanted to bend a pipe a certain way to get it into the boat a certain way, and he said, "Here, hold this," and I held it, and he came with a big anvil. And he dropped it on top of that pipe. And he bent it, bloom, and I was still holding it. he said, yeah. He said, "But look, see, she bent it. We bent it the right way." He constantly thought of me. I think my daddy thought of me plenty as a boy, you know, the boy that worked with him. What's the matter, sugar?
So... let's fast forward.
Okay.
To your years as a teacher.
Did you
ever teach students, your students, about the early Filipinos of Louisiana?
No, an occasion never showed up except once or twice when one of my sixth grade students asked me. And he was a very... very nice boy, and curious, I guess, just like the rest of the children. And it's him, "Miss Welch, you're not going to get mad when I'm going to ask." I said, "I don't know. What are you going to ask me, you know?" He says, "Oh, you Chinese or Japanese?" And that was not a question that was very odd to me, because the children had been asking, people had been asking me this for years. And I would say, sometimes if I had time, I would say, "I'm Nita, I'm Filipino, and next time you ask me, I'll tell you what it is," you know, or something like that. But lots of times they would never say, they would just say Chinese or Japanese, because of our war with Japan. You understand? because of the war with Japan. They wanted to know if I was Chinese or Japanese. They didn't know Filipinos. And so one time I was teaching a sixth grade class, and the boy said, "Miss White, she's not going to get mad if I ask you, Hannah." I said, "I know what you're going to ask me. You're going to ask me if I'm Chinese or Japanese." "Yeah." I said, "You're not the first, and I'm sure you're not going to be the last to ask me what I am." I said, "And I'm neither one." And they went, I said, "I'm a Filipino." And they went, "What's that?" And so I said, "I tell you what," I said, "we're going to make a real lesson of it." I said, "I'm going to treat it just like a lesson that I would teach you." I said, "We're going to do it with maps and everything." I said, "But you're going to have to be tested on it." He said, and they said, "Oh, that's okay, that's okay, that's all right with us, you know." So anyway, I went to the library and I found big maps of the Philippine Islands, and in respect with where it laid in the part of the sea, and you know, and then of course I started off with the Voyage of Magellan, you know, that's how we did it. Oh, those kids ate it up. It was really amazing. How they ate that up, because they thought, you know, that they were learning something that nobody else on the earth knew. That was the kick. I really enjoyed teaching, you know, in sixth grade, you know, and having that part of the world to teach them.
Was that common knowledge about the Filipinos, the early Filipinos in Louisiana? Do people?
No, they never knew. When I was. I went through all the way through high school and college. They asked me what I was, you know. Believe it or not, yes. Believe it or not, they always thought Chinese or Japanese. But then when we had the war with Japan, they got to know a little bit more. And then they got to know a little bit better, you know. And I think they understand a little bit more and appreciate it a little bit better. I became famous. I mean, I became Teacher of the Year and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. and it's because they suddenly realized that there's other parts of the world that they didn't know. And they were glad to learn it, and then after the war, you know, it was even better.
So okay, so our listeners could appreciate this. What's your background? So, your father.
My father's from Manila, and I just don't know how much was what, you know, how much Filipino blood he had in him. I'm sure it was you know, kind of pure.
And then your mother.
Then my mother's father was pure Filipino, but my mother's mother, which is all the European nations, and then I got a lot of it, you know, from my father and from my mother, I guess if I had married a Filipino, it would continue, you know. But Bill came along, our family is like half Filipino and half all the other stuff, you know.
So given your background, what do you consider yourself, how would you describe yourself?
American. Yeah, that's all I've always done. I decided myself as an American. That's it, you know. And if they ask me what generation, I would always say I'm Asian and I'm the rest of the nations, because I do have a little bit of everything, you know, in me, Yeah. Can you see this picture here?
Okay, tell us what we're seeing.
That's a picture of my sister and a picture of me. My sister was 18 and I'm 16 in that picture, because she was getting ready to graduate from high school, and I had a year more, 2 years more to go. And but you see, I have got more of the Filipina look than she does. You see that? Can you see that? You see how she's got more of the lengthy face, whereas mine more of a round face? You see? More of the Filipino look than her. And there were just only the two of us. And she's got two of the most beautiful girls you could ever lay eyes on. Huh, Bill? Celie's two girls. Celie's two girls. Yeah. Ann and Gail. They are beautiful girls. She didn't marry a Filipino man. She married German and something else. But they have a Filipino look, but they don't have the look of the Filipinos, you know. Yes. They're really beautiful girls.
So you would consider yourself an American first?
Oh, yes. When anybody asks me what I am, I'd say American, you see, because that's easy to say than to try to say, well, I got some of this blood in me, I got some of that blood in me, I'm an American.
Do people still live on Manila Village?
Oh, yes.
In Manila Village? There's still people in
Manila? Oh, you mean Manila? No. No, it's gone now. It's gone. The 1949 storm took it away completely. There was nothing left on it. Mm-hmm. And they just have one. What was this star, this pole, this pipe made of, Daddy?
The what?
The big pipe, you know, where they boil the shrimp?
Oh, yeah, whatever. The bat used to be, they call them big bats with it.
They boil the shrimp. And that was this big pipe that was made of some important and good material. And then somebody went there and stole that and took that away. So there's nothing, absolutely nothing there. Yeah, the only thing left there, pilings, and I guess as storms come by and everything, that there won't be any more.
Okay. So can you say that? So does Manila, if you could say Manila, I need you to say Manila Village,
yeah.
Because I can't say it because
okay.
You're the one in the story. So.
Yeah.
What happened to Manila Village? Does Manila Village still exist?
No, we're very sorry to say Manila Village does not exist anymore. We might find some pilings and posts and all that might have been left there, but the 19, Betsy, 19, what, Bill?
I don't remember what the date was.
Oh, how about this? What if you say it was a hurricane?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So.
Betsy.
Okay. So.
Hurricane
okay.
Betsy.
Okay.
And I think it was 1949.
Okay. So can you start?
Okay. In 1949, the Hurricane Betsy came. No, he said no. What?
49.
Hold on.
Okay.
So let's go back a little bit. So what happened to Manila Village? Does it still exist?
No, unfortunately, it was beginning to deteriorate anyway. People were moving away from the village, the whole village. It was beginning to deteriorate. People wasn't staying there anymore. Fishermen used to at least have their own camp there, and their wives used to stay there while they went out to fish. But one storm came by, and everybody kind of moved away. It kind of came closer to town. where it would be safe. And then 1965, Hurricane Betsy came and just wiped it all away. The only thing that was left was maybe some posts and everything. And then much later on, people start scavenging, you know, taking everything. Because some of those posts had been there for so many years. I mean, you know, they were almost like made up iron or something. And but now it is all gone. I don't think that there's even any kind of markers around that would be, you know.
And they happened something lately, but they built the oil company built a little canal through Manila Village.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's true, too. The oil company came by.
They built a canal through it.
Yeah. So there's no more. So Manila Village is only in our thoughts and our pictures. That's it.
What was your reaction when during that hurricane and how it affected, how it wiped out Manila Village? Do you remember how you...
Let's see. In 65, where were we, Bill? We were here.
We were right here, and your dad, we went down and got your mother and daddy from Myrtle Grove.
Right.
Came
yes.
here with them. They stood here doing the hurricane with us.
Okay,
yes.
So could you... All right, can you tell us where were you?
Well, yeah... we could always tell, you know, how the weather, and of course, the people around here in this area are always afraid of hurricanes and so forth, and so they always try to prepare for it. And then I remember our family started to coming in, and so we kept looking for my mom and daddy, and so finally we got a call. And mom said, go and pick up your mom and daddy, you know, because they had their boat parked almost to the road where the cars would pass, you know, to pick them up. So we were all, everybody was coming in, and we were the only one going out. Yeah, that was the truth. We had no trouble getting down there because there was no traffic whatsoever. And so we went there. They were all ready. We put them in a car, and then we came on home. And once we got home, we start boarding up our house, you know, because hurricanes, nothing to be laughed at or even take lightly. And so, and thank goodness they spent the whole time here. Then the next day when it was over with, my mom and daddy, we could tell that they were anxious to go down there, but some of the family went down there, and the police stopped them. They didn't want them to go any further, so they came onto this side, and so that was not going to stop any of my cousins, you know, they go there and they do any kind of thing. So they all got together and they went all the way around by Terry?
Lafitte.
And then they came around and found my daddy's boat intact, honey. Fine. A man, he was in a car, Bill?
Yeah, he was trying to get in, but he couldn't. The water got done. He couldn't get further.
He couldn't have.
So he took refuge on my father's
boat. He broke a lock and got in my father's boat and saved his life and saved my daddy's boat. Because my daddy had the lines, you know, and then when the water started raising, the lines would have held the boat down. You see? And so, and he was able to let the lines out so the boat would float up and not be sunk. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was something. So he left a little note and he said he saw, he ate the food that my mama had and everything. And my daddy said, I always wanted to meet that man and thank him, Mr. Because maybe he saved his life, but he saved his boat. Yes, indeed.
Okay, well, what I'm going to do here.
Mm-hmm.
So you said that Manila Village exists, is no more, but it exists in our memories.
In our pictures,
in
yes.
In our pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me, what are we looking at? What is this?
Now, this is Cabanache. Manila Village was like in a bay, like this, okay? And then across the bay was another little village like this that they call Cabanache, okay? Manila Village and Cabanache. It was pulling distance or paddling distance from each other. But over here, there was no stores or anything. There were just camps that people lived in. Okay?
What is this? Is this a picture? What is this? We can't see this. So can you describe this to us?
This is a sketch of Cabanache. And this is the house that we lived in. This is the first house I remember, first home that I remember. This is the cistern. See, for the water? We'd gather water from the cistern. And this was a little two-room cabin. People used to go there and build a cabin. This was the round house, and this cabin here. And then later on, it was two more cabins, and then was my grandmother's cabin. And everybody used to go there and stay and just take over. I should explain what a seine crew is. Okay. A seine crew is a crew of men that do the seining. And in my mother's time, my uncle used to be a seine captain. I think he had like 18 men. And I don't know if they built the ship themselves, the boat themselves, the cabin themselves or what, but anyway, there was a cabin there for 18 men. And my older... The older men... The men that were there, the captain provided everything for them, a place to sleep, a place to eat, a place to wash their clothes, to wash themselves, or whatever. The seine crew. They didn't have many. I don't remember many seine crews because that was an earlier time, you know. But That was an experience too.
How many men to a seine crew?
It could be anywhere from, I'd say, 8 to 16, 17, 18. You know, it depends. First, you'd have to build a seine. You'd have to make the seine, you know. That was the woman's job. God, did they knit? Sometimes you could hardly see the knitting needle, you know, going. They used to knit.
Did you do that?
I used to knit, but I was not very good at it. I mean, I was not very fast. I used to knit, yeah. They'd give me different little things to knit, you know, something that they would call a crescido or something that they have to have here or something to fit in between two other things, you know. That let me knit, the women did that, and sometimes the boys they thought that was beneath them, you know, to do that.
Well, let's go back to these pictures. Can you tell me, because I won't be able to introduce this, can you say something like, here are pictures you wrote down from memory, so can you tell me, how about something like, here's some pictures of Manila Village that I drew from memory. Okay, hold on. Let's wait until Bill gets a chance to sit down. Okay.
That's a sketch. These are sketches from Cabanache. It laid on the opposite end of the bay where Manila Village was. And matter of fact, that was the address. We actually had an address. Cabanache Post Office, Manila Village, Louisiana. my dad, I've got it someplace. My daddy, when I went off to college, my daddy wrote me a letter, and I kept it specifically because it had the return address of Cavanash Post Office, Manila Village, Louisiana. Yeah, I still have that someplace. I kept all of that.
Okay. Do you mind repeating that just because you moved around a lot? And I'm trying to make this really clean so that, again, there isn't that much destruction.
I'm looking at some sketches I made of Cavanash, a little village that was in the opposite end of the bay from Manila Village. And all those camps were made built by the men and that would come there and build a place for their families. Sometimes they would stay all year, sometimes they wouldn't. All depend on the season of shrimp, you know. And it was always there. And that was the post office. They even had a post office. I mean, it was called Cavanash Post Office, Manila Village, Louisiana.
Why did you sketch these pictures?
Just to have them in mind. I didn't want, when the last time I went out there, it was gone. Just posts. All you saw was posts. So I sat down and I tried to remember how it looked, because I lived in nearly every one of those camps, one way or the other. Either with my mother stayed with a sister, you know, had dad who had children, or we lived alone, or something like that. But I just didn't want to let it. I leave out of my mind, and so before I could forget about it at all, I just made little sketches of it and put it in there.
Okay. So what I'm